Launched in 2020 as a resource for teachers navigating the COVID-19 pandemic, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is a podcast about all things early childhood teaching. I'm Dr. Christine Lippard, and each episode I interview researchers, classroom teachers, or other early childhood practitioners on a specific early childhood education topic. Intended to provide research background, practical ideas, and cheering on from a distance, Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is the long-distance mentoring your teacher prep faculty wish they could provide. In this episode, Dr. Rachel Albert talks to me about her work with infant language and contingent responding. We talk about what we might learn from that to apply to working with older children as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me. So my name is Rachel Albert, and I am an associate professor at Lebanon Valley College, which is a small school in central Pennsylvania. And I'm a developmental scientist. So I'm in a psychology department, and I really come at language from kind of this other perspective of thinking about how do babies develop language through interactions with their caregivers. And for a long time, I was looking at caregivers as parents, and really looking at how do babies use their vocalizations to develop opportunities for learning. And only recently have kind of started to kind of switch. So it's how do babies learn language? Why do babies babble? How do infant babbles impact their caregivers? So that's kind of the focus of my research and interest in early language development.
And I think that's so interesting. I'm excited to hear more because I think we often talk about it with parents and especially with teachers, like, here's what you need to do to language model and here's what you need to remember. And this idea that not that babies are responsible for it, but they are capable of initiating and attracting those caregiver interactions. And then we get to be in a place to be responsive is super interesting. So on the podcast so far, I've talked with several folks about communication and responsiveness, but not with anybody who's looking at babies. Tell us a little bit more about how you got interested in babies and very early communication.
So it's kind of a wandering path I ended up here. And it started in undergrad. I was working in our lab school. We had a preschool attached to my undergrad at Ohio Wesleyan University. And I was really interested in preschool development. And I was doing a honors thesis kind of project on children's road crossing behaviors. And it turned into this whole thing, but it led to me working in an early childhood education center for several years. And that led me to stumble into grad school to this topic, knowing that I loved working with kids and wanting to figure out how they work. And so grad school really became the parent-infant connection. But where it got kind of more interesting for your listeners, I think, is really when I became a mom myself, got really interested in the other caregivers in my children's lives, right? And recognizing that when I was putting my kids in childcare for almost 50 hours a week, it was like, okay, well, who are these wonderful people who are taking care of my kids? And, you know, how much, you know, they've got so much time and how much opportunity for learning is happening outside of me. What does that look like? And, you know, my grad work was really understanding how responsiveness to babbling matters for learning, and that parents use a lot of these infant cues in specific ways to provide opportunities for learning. And so I got really curious about, well, what's happening in the childcare classrooms? Do these same patterns hold, or how do the different demands of a childcare classroom change those interactions when you've got way more kids to focus on, when you've got kids at a huge age range? You know, if we've got a 6-week-old and a 6-month-old and 9-month-old, how are all those different abilities shaping my responsiveness and impacting response patterns? And so that's what I've really been kind of starting to shift the last 5 or 6 years into, kind of digging into the, you know, these other caregivers, these non-parent caregivers, and saying what's happening in classrooms.
And what are you seeing there? What are some of the findings that have been really interesting to you?
It's several things, and kind of blend, you know, what we know about parents and then the childcare teachers, infant classroom teachers as we go here. The key thing, you know, is that the take home here is, like, these pre-linguistic vocalizations, these early babbles in the first year, really create a lot of these opportunities for learning for infants. You know, so the first finding is that baby babbles attract caregivers' attention, right? They're salient, people latch into them, they respond. But what's really cool, and this is new work that I'm doing with Claire Villot in Michigan State, is we've been coding childcare classroom teachers' language to babies. And we found that when teachers are responding contingently to baby babbles, so those kind of conversational turn-taking reactions. They are simplifying their mean length of utterance. They're using fewer unique words. They're using more single word utterances compared to when they're just talking at other times. So again, suggesting that these vocalizations are attracting attention and caregivers are sensitive to that and simplifying their speech. And parents do this too, but it kind of shows that infant vocalizations are creating these moments for learning, right? It's always, you know, why does contingency matter? What does contingency do to a baby? So the first thing is that caregivers respond differently to babies' babbles. They simplify, which is great. But in addition to simplifying, we're finding that teachers and parents alike respond in particular ways to those vocalizations. They provide more descriptions, more specific language, more object labels. So things that are providing concrete opportunities to learn. And the third thing, which is, you know, so this is kind of common knowledge, we understand this, but it's the baby side of what is the baby contributing to this? Why is these contingent responses matter? And a lot of my earlier work suggests that when babies vocalize, they're either signaling or creating a state of arousal and attention that is actually making them more receptive to learning after the vocalization. So it's not just that contingency matters because caregivers change what they say. Contingency matters because those moments after the baby's vocalized are actually times where they're signaling, hey, I'm interested in this, tell me more, but I'm actually in a place that's more ready to learn. So we've got some work that came out of the Goldstein Lab where I did my grad work, where we provided object labels to babies right after they babbled versus when they were silently looking at it. So still joint attention in both cases, but in one case right after they vocalize. And babies will learn those 11-month-olds will learn those object labels better if they hear it right after they babbled. So again, this kind of attention signaling, I'm ready to learn. So it kind of gets this full circle of, you know, caregivers provide simplified information after babies babble, but it's coming at a time when babies are more receptive to that information. So we're kind of poking at this from a whole bunch of different angles and trying to look at this. I guess the one other thing I'll say, you know, about the kind of framework of my work here is that visual gaze is a really salient cue of where babies are looking when they babble. So when they babble at objects, we call object-directed vocalizations, caregivers tend to be really toned in on those, right? And just my more descriptions, questions, specific information right after object-directed vocalization versus undirected or even caregiver-directed babbling. And those moments after ODVs, again, seem to be these opportunities, at least in parent-infant interactions, and I suspect might even be even more important in childcare settings for babies to learn. So visual gaze is this really salient cue to all caregivers, and they seem to latch on to that. That was a lot of information.
No, that's great. You're making me think of about like 1,000 things. So I want to try to remember to come back and ask you. Well, maybe I'll just ask you now. So I love this because when I talk with my students, I talk about how in their careers, they're going to hear lots of things about evidence-based practice. And that means they need to be able to at least find for themselves, like, what is the evidence people are talking about? Like, we go all the way back and watch the nice old videos of like Harry Harlow's monkeys and talk about the importance of teacher as a secure base for children to explore in the classroom. So I love what you just shared because it gives us the research base from which we can probably draw some practical implications. And so when you think about, well, so you have young children at home. And so as you were learning this, did you catch yourself either changing your interactions with them or noticing things about your interactions with them?
Absolutely. I think in kind of that one-on-one playtime with them, I'd certainly notice myself honing in and kind of responding. I think there's a couple things that like I have in the back of my head that I think maybe aren't at the forefront of most parents and teachers' interactions of thinking about like, what is the sweet spot on contingent responding, right? Is that you don't want to respond to everything. If a kid gets a response every time that they babble, that's boring. That's too predictable. And so, you know, what is the right level of letting things go versus not? And when we look at parent interactions, we know that there's a huge range and teachers too, and kind of individual variability of how often do people respond. But what one of the things parents seem to do is over time become more selective to the quality of the vocalization that the babies are producing. So they're more likely to respond to those more advanced ba-bas and da-das and let some of those more immature kind of fussy noises go. And so the vocal quality starts to kind of shape up you know, to more advanced sounds, and parent caregivers kind of reinforce and scaffold those more advanced vocalizations. That is something that I'm really interested in looking at in like the teachers more, because teachers have more infants at more different ranges of vocal development and so many more task demands of keeping track of, you know, 4 to 8 kids at once. How much of that kind of shaping to an individual infant's vocal ability is happening or is able to happen in a child care classroom? And so I think I paid, you know, attention to that a lot, of kind of being tuned into vocal coding and kind of saying, oh, that was a really good sound, I'm going to talk about that, and being more aware of that. I think parents are naturally doing that without giving it a lot of thought. I wonder if teachers, and this is just like speculating, I'm trying to understand more about the dynamics of classrooms, have to be, you know, Do we have the mental energy to be able to keep track of that at the same way when there's so many other things going on? From like kind of these isolated studies we've done with teachers where we've given them different range of vocalizations and had them react and rate them, we know that teachers can tell the difference between different qualities of infant sounds in the first year the same way parents are doing. But in the isolated lab studies that I've done where I've had them respond to different vocals, they don't seem to discriminate based on quality the same way parents do. And so I'm trying to probe that deeper to kind of say, well, how are all these factors mattering here? And how does this get messier when you put them in front of multiple kids and not just one kid and all of that?
Right. There are two things I'm going to ask you about. And I understand that I'm stretching a little beyond, you know, what you would necessarily claim as expertise, but you certainly know more than me. And so we'll let you go there. It was funny, the whole first year of the podcast, I'd be like, great, this is your expertise. Thanks. Now, what do we do during COVID? And people would be like, I didn't do research on what we do during COVID. And I was like, I know, but you know better than the rest of us. So help us out. So as I think about this, I think about two things. So one of the things, especially in training pre-service teachers, but even with teachers, when you go in to observe, I think there's this sense of, even with infant and toddler teachers, like we need to be doing activities, and they get busy in the doing and the managing of materials and those things on top of all the caregiving routines, diaper changes and putting people down for naps and those sorts of things. But it seems to me that your research would make a strong argument for leaving sort of free play time where the teacher is engaged and available, but available. Is that what you're seeing, or is that a fair takeaway?
I think that is, you know, we get the sense from looking at these free play sessions with certain teachers, and it's not all, but that, and I sense that maybe there's this message that's coming down in maybe professional development and ECE education that, you know, language is so important. We need to give lots of opportunities to, you know, talk. Dana Suskin has kind of this early 3 T's intervention kind of thing of the 3 T's: tune in, talk, take turns, and talk more, I think is her 3 T's, right? And I would argue that the tuning in and taking turns is absolutely, like, you know, trying to create those conversational turn-taking opportunities is great. Following the intention of the baby is great. But talking more, I want to kind of like put a little asterisk on that and tweak that, right? Is that teachers don't need to feel the pressure to talk more or talk constantly, right? Is that it's exhausting.
And it's exhausting to hear, like being on the other side of it. It's exhausting for both parties.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I'm hoping, you know, a takeaway here is that sensitive contingent responses, it's finding those moments when is the baby going to be receptive? And obviously with multiple kids, that could be, you know, you are doing more talking because you're responding to multiple children, but it is, you know, how do you talk contingently and sensitively and find that Goldilocks sweet spot of that just right, not talking constantly. And so I think, you know, when you're doing these activities and letting, you know, and kids are engaged, it's fine to have some quiet time and have some time where they're just engaged, and then looking for those moments of, you know, they've babbled and they've, you know, how do I respond to that? How do I comment on that or encourage them? So I think that that's absolutely the kind of take home, right? Is how to talk in a way that is potentially facilitating language opportunities, but that's sustainable for everyone.
And natural. And so maybe that brings me to my second question, because I think if you feel the pressure to talk all the time, then you do sort of distance yourself from it and put on this like character voice. I don't know if you're seeing this. I see this often. And so that's why I'm thinking of it, but it's almost like teachers switch into not like disciplinary teacher voice, but like disconnected, you know,
more like narrating their, you know, the thought process of saying like, now we have to do this. And let's
But not to say that narrating is bad, because I think, you know, even to say to, I'm just using my own kid's name so I don't start using names from our actual lab school, but you know, Ella, did you see that Joshy, you know, notice when you walk by, look, he's looking at you, like that kind of narrating. But the like, Ella needs to go to the carpet so that Joshy has space to play, like the kind of monotone, or it just feels disconnected. I'm wondering if teachers didn't feel the pressure to talk all the time, if it would be easier to stay sort of in those authentic interactions. So I'm wondering if you, is this a phenomenon you've seen? And what would you say about sort of the importance of authenticity or connectedness in those communications?
So I think I know what you're kind of referring to from watching my own children in kind of childcare sections and settings and things like that. I haven't seen this so much in the data I've collected because we're mostly pulling kids out for one-on-one interactions, and we're trying to scale up to kind of more of the more naturalistic messiness of classroom settings. And so I suspect it probably happens less when you're one-on-one with a child and more in this. But I think about, so Sheila Degatardi from Australia has a lot of work kind of looking at child-directed speech versus overheard speech in the classroom. I'm speculating on what you're kind of just saying. I wonder if kids start to tune out and treat some of that kind of robot voice narration as not child-directed speech, as more of this adult overheard kind of speech and just kind of background noise, because it's not coming with the same characteristics of the infant-directed speech, pitch modulation, more directed focus. Like, that would be really interesting to try to look at more and say, you know, are kids still treating that the same way, or do they start to classify that differently and maybe even tune it out differently to the same way that teacher-to-teacher conversation is not honed in on the same way as teacher-child interactions?
Right, really, like it's not salient to them. It's funny because it all, and I see it reflected in my children too. Like I have a 3.5-year-old, and so she's getting into dramatic play, and so she will play school and I'll hear her switch into it. But it's almost like having, you know, Dora the Explorer in the room, like, do you see your shoes? You found your shoe, you know, where it is, like it's meant for mass consumption. Not that that's always bad. I don't think either of us are saying there's an always right or an always wrong way, but I often think that teachers would enact better practices, you know, more authentic and meaningful practices, and you feel pressure of other things. So I wonder if that's some of it. So I like that idea of being able to say, look, it's not just the total volume of speech, but it's what you're doing. We have a researcher that's in our School of Education, Connie Beecher, and she does a lot of extension work. So she does a lot of work with parents on language interactions with kids. And she describes language learning as kids like are walking around with a cup, trying to fill the cup up with language, and that teachers act like sprinklers. And so kids really need like the hose or the faucet, but teachers are sprinklers. And so kids are just catching a few drops. She looks at preschoolers a lot, but it makes me think of what you're saying of this tailored response is really meaningful.
Absolutely. I think you get a lot more bang for your buck if you're doing kind of these more selective focused things and not feeling the need to constantly be communicating or giving lots and lots of utterances out there.
And you're right that it's exhausting. I remember driving home from teaching preschool and turning the radio off, turning the air conditioner down because it was too loud, and just driving in silence because I was so tired of hearing myself. I would do a lot of things differently if I went back and taught preschool now. When I checked out your faculty bio, I saw that you run the baby lab. And so tell us about what's going on in the baby lab, which also looked like the most fun lab space you could have.
It is fun. I mean, I love doing it. Of course, COVID has kind of put a big halt on a lot of things. We still are not back to asking families with, you know, young infants to come to campus yet. And we'll probably wait another, at least till the spring, to revisit whether we're going to be able to do that. And so this has kind of created this nice opportunity to have these collaborations with other researchers who have collected all of this, these lab school, you know, video data sets and things like that that I've been mining, rather than getting to bring babies to campus to do new stuff, which has been wonderful to go deeper on these questions. And so I think, you know, most of what the lab has been doing, we're kind of hitting on here already with looking at pre-linguistic, so, you know, babies between 9 and 14 months, kind of at that cusp of first words, looking at the cues that they're putting out there and how teachers and parents respond to them at different times. And so we've been kind of coding all of those behaviors, trying to kind of look at what kind of cues that babies put out there, whether it's their vocal quality or where they're looking, shape and change, the kind of things that caregivers and teachers say. So that's kind of the bulk of it. What we're trying to go to, and you know, is we kind of build these relationships with other researchers who have access, is I know a lot of the lab schools have, you know, recording setups. And if I can get mics on multiple kids, I would love to really start to expand looking at those opportunities in our, you know, the full degrees of freedom of a childcare classroom and say, could I put mics on 4 infants throughout the day and see what do the contingency rates look like in classrooms under what circumstances, how do kids in clustered activities, what kind of language opportunities are you getting? How's that changing? Of course, lots and lots of researchers are doing this on kind of a more macro level, using a lot of the kind of different scales and kind of rating systems to kind of classify sensitivity. But I'm really interested in like turning up that microscope to say, like, when baby A makes this kind of sound, what is the likelihood that they're going to get a reaction? And what will that vocalization or what will that response kind of be? Will it be a description? Will it be an imitation? All of those types of things. So that's where I'm hoping to go. I just need to, you know, find those schools that are doing those recordings and see if we can kind of start to mine it.
Okay. So thinking about like bringing this into the classroom. And I know that you said you had some experience, especially with preschoolers, but of course you've also like lived infant toddler. When you think about how these findings sort of land for folks that maybe feel a little stuck communicating with babies, whether it's parents or pre-service teachers or whoever, but that kind of go, I don't really know what to talk to them about, and they're not going to talk back. What do you suggest, or what are practical tips you would give, especially for that really early communication?
So I want to put like that, this is one of my pet peeves of when people say that they're not talking back. And I want to be like, well, they're not using words yet, but they are talking back, right? You've made the point, right, that relationships are key, right? That this is what we're doing. And I think that that's the key thing here too, is that it's all about conversational interactions with infants. And yes, when they say it's not the same level. Right? It's more work on the caregiver to carry the conversation, but they are communicating, they are responding back. And so it's treating it just like you would with an adult or an older preschooler, is how do you react? How do you continue that conversation? Almost half of what people say back are these conversational placeholders. Oh yeah? Oh, tell me more. Uh-huh. And so we do react kind of in that trying to continue the conversation way naturally. But I think it's thinking about as we get into the second half of the first year, you know, joint attention. And if they're looking at something, you can talk about that thing. You can ask a question about thing. You can describe. And so it is that those relationships that lead to turn taking and engagement. And I think that's kind of my key thing, is not talking to talk, but talking to engage. And yeah, that would probably be my biggest takeaway. If teachers kind of rethought how language development works, it's coming down to those conversations more than just exposure. Of course, kids can learn passively. They can learn from overheard speech, but these moments of particularly reacting to babbles, but other cues too, like points and gestures and things like that, tend to be these salient moments for being receptive to that input.
And I think that's a good point too. You said at the end, these might be initiators too, of pointing or, but I think children do that as well. They give nonverbal cues as well. So absolutely. even if they don't babble back at you, they look at you or they look away or they, you know, point at things, that idea of sort of being in the moment. I think the other thing, you were too kind to say this, is that adults kind of have to get over themselves. Like, especially if there are other adults in the room, like in childcare, I think we get super self-conscious. So this is making me think too. This is really helpful. I'm always trying to learn more so that I can help my pre-service teachers learn more. And, you know, I often, the first hurdle when they're just uncomfortable talking, I say, talk about anything. Like, talk about what you had for breakfast. Talk about what you saw on your walk-in. Like, just talk. But then I think I haven't had a good go-to for like, okay, now you're comfortable talking. How do we get you skilled? Mm-hmm. And so this idea, I think the scaffolding of it is, okay, now don't talk about you. Talk about them. Even if it's, I see that you're laying on the blue mat. Did you see that Josh just got here? You know, those sorts of things. And then over time, helping push them to really tune into, what is this baby looking at? Or what vocalizations are you hearing? Or what does it look like they're interested in talking about? But I'm not sure that many of them could make that jump first.
Yeah, I think questions and descriptions are kind of the two great starting points. And even just conversation placeholders of just reacting and responding. Oh yeah, tell me more. Hi, you know, just that just gets you going, right? But those descriptions, those questions, what are you looking at? Is that blue? Can you roll it? Any of those kind of prompting to engage, you know, describing what they're looking at. That I think comes naturally to people when you look at it, it's like, oh, you've got a ball. What are you doing with the ball? Right? Like we can spend 10 minutes talking about the ball and it's boring for an adult to do that, but the kid is fascinated. And so I think that is one of the biggest things that I've seen with, especially with undergraduate students where we've done things, not in necessarily in childcare settings, but we've brought undergrads in to play with babies just to see, you know, what, is there something about becoming a parent that changes how people respond or what are people's natural interests? That was kind of a study I did a while ago. And I think a lot of times undergrad, it's the boredom factor, right? Is that like, you can sit there and say, I don't want to have a 20-minute conversation about this ball, but that's where the 6-month-old is. And they also don't have the same rich, like you're sitting there, you can kind of multitask, but you can be thinking about your grocery list in the back of your head while also continuing this conversation about the ball. So I think that getting over that boredom factor of with an adult, we'd never continue this conversation the same way. And so it seems a little bit insane, you know, it seems uncomfortable. I think that's where a lot of the uncomfort comes from, is that like the repetition, the focus on this very simple thing, but recognizing, seeing the baby, meeting them where they're at, right? Is that this is, they're happy to engage with this single object for 20 minutes. And so let's sit there and play with that. But even, you know, any language, especially in contingency, imitations, these affirming kind of language, it's all examples of syntax. It's all examples of phonological development. It's all things that are going to help babies parse. This is a word. This is not a word. This is where boundaries end and one word begins and one word stops. So all of this speech is good examples, regardless of what it is. But I think you're right, is that scaffolding over time can happen where we kind of become more sensitive to responding to what the baby's doing. And certainly the things you're doing at different ages, you know, 11-month-old is on the cusp of learning a word. And so labeling that object becomes more of a purposeful kind of conversation. Whereas a 6-month-old, the conversation is more just helping them parse language and figure out phonemes and syntax and boundaries. So I wonder too, if, you know, teachers want to teach, right? We want to feel like we're doing the right thing. And so I think that restructuring of language and this purpose, these early conversations, it's teaching, right? It's teaching at this really most basic level. And I think that reframing might help people who are hesitant, is I'm providing these examples of language at the most basic units that is helpful for this child.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful and also alleviates any anxiety about being wrong. Like, what if I said, oh, you're looking at the ball, and they actually were looking at something else? And it's like, well, okay. But as they have these positive responsive language interactions, hopefully thousands of times over that first year, you're not going to mess them up by being wrong once.
Absolutely.
Especially for ball. Cause boy, if that isn't an early word, we hear a lot of ball and sop, and undone in our house right now. Yes. With a 1.5-year-old. Absolutely. You can tell what he says to his sister, right? Stop. Ada. She is not a contingent responder. Mm. She doesn't pick up on the cue. Well, I'm going to ask you to speculate here for listeners who might not work with babies, but if you're working in early childhood education, you are going to work with children who are unable to communicate with you verbally, either because they have a disability or a language delay, or because they're a dual language learner and they don't know enough of your language yet to communicate with you in that. So again, moving away from babbling, but still this idea, I think, of contingency. Are there lessons to learn or things we could draw from your work that would apply to older children we might work with who we still have limited verbal communication with?
I think the same basic message applies all the way up, is that those conversations and connection is still the key, right? Kids, people of all ages, they want to feel engaged. They want to feel listened to. Getting down at the 4-year-old's level and connecting with them and knowing that they have your full attention in this moment, to even if there's a disconnect and you're struggling to understand what they're saying, you're trying, right? And and that's where I think returning to some of that pre-linguistic conversation kind of stuff, is a lot of it is that guesswork and trying to, oh, you mean this? Nope, this. Let me try again. Can you tell me a different way? Relying on gestures, relying on nonverbal. I think returning to some of those roots, I mean, you don't want to be infantiling about it, right? You don't want to be derogatory in that way of simplifying too much, but returning to some of those basic communication strategies that we use with the under ones, I think apply in a lot of these kind of situations where you have nonverbal communicators, where you have dual language learners and you're trying to guess. I mean, I think about how a lot of the apps are, and the best way to learn a second language is watching children's TV because of the repetition and the breakdown and the simplification. And so I think that that continues to apply all the way up. But I don't know that I can be much more specific.
That's great. And I think, you know, no matter who I talk to, Diane Horn, Susan Sheridan about families, teachers who are like in the classroom right now, everybody comes back to it's relationships and positive responsive interactions that matter. So, I mean, I could just stop the podcast, I think, and say like, what do we do to help teachers have more positive responsive relationships? Yeah. So no, I think that's great. You're right. That applies all the way up. And I appreciate the point too about not sort of like infantilizing it. And the idea of what is teaching, that you don't need to take a dual language learner and walk around the room and just point and label until they repeat you. Like, that's not meaningful. Their brain, you were talking about the brain arousal with babbling to then be ready for input. And so thinking about too, like for children, for older children, what are, you know, teachers can watch for those cues of what are we ready to learn? What are you interested in? And how do we build language there? Anyway, I'm getting off on a tangent.
No, that's how it all scales up right for me. And I look at what my older kids are doing. And when you hit on something that they're engaged in and they're interested in the moment, you can get them to make leaps and bounds of progress versus sitting down and being like, fill out this worksheet or do this thing when they're not into it is just like pulling teeth. And so that those authentic learning experiences where the kids are engaged and being able to, you know, even when that's outside of your plan of like, I really wanted to do this other thing, but this is this moment to pivot and go with it. I think those can be really powerful.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to restrain myself from getting off on an emergent curriculum tangent because I could from what you just said, but that could be its whole own podcast. So I'll ask you one last question. So if you were chatting with new teachers, what would you want to tell them?
So let me, two things. So on the COVID side of things, I'm like, how things are different. I've heard a lot of concern, both from parents and teachers, about masks and learning opportunities for language in childcare classrooms, right? Is how are they possibly learning? And what's really cool, at least in the work for typically developing kids, so I'm not talking about kids with hearing impairments or things like that, but for typically developing kids, especially under 18 months, they're not looking at the caregiver's faces to learn language at all. Almost all the research suggests they're following what caregiver's hands are doing and using that as cues. And so the masks are, of course, masks for social, emotional development and communicating emotional expression are, you know, we can do expressive with our eyes. But from a language perspective, I think there's very little fear there that like the mask is going to be limiting opportunities in any way because they're following the hands. They're actually looking much more at what the objects are and the other things in the environment, rarely looking at caregivers' faces and all the things that we've looked at. So I think that that can be maybe reassuring to some of your teachers is that you don't need that eye contact as much for language opportunity. And so I think for like the under two classrooms, very little in the COVID world has potentially had to change or need, you know, necessarily change. Yes, there's more cleaning and structure and things like that. But my suspicion is that not as much has changed in those early classrooms as people initially feared when we transitioned into all of these different kind of new procedures and things like that. On the, you know, new teacher front broadly, I'm just, you know, going to drill this home one more time. And I think is not feeling the need to talk just to talk and fill space, but again, finding those ways for those authentic conversations is, and that might, I'm sure with multiple kids look like still exhausting of trying to seek out one-on-one connections at different times. I know Diane Horn's done some work with like the changing routines and saying like, you know, changing diapers or doing some feeding is like the most concentrated time for one-on-one interaction. So can you take advantage of those times to have those conversational turn-taking interactions, but giving that space for the kids to have some silence in their day is an okay thing. And so I think I would want to reassure new teachers on that is to save your energy, look for those moments. It shouldn't feel pressure. It should feel authentic. It should feel when you want to comment on what the child's doing or engage them in something. But I think that that is something, and so I could stop there. I'm curious, Christine, though, about your thoughts on this, because this is again, me, like, I want to stay in my lane and not over, you know, the parenting side of things. I don't know. But my sense is with early childhood education, I don't know if this is coming down with like professional development or in some of the curriculum for education, is if there's a lot of focus on milestones in development, right? And watching for those milestones and using those milestones as gauge points about where a child should be, right? I've heard you talk about this before with typical, you know, where a kid's at on range of reaction versus normal reaction, right? And all of these things. But I'm curious about this in the work that we were talking about earlier with vocal development, is that if I'm relying as a teacher on like motor cues as a gauge of like what a child is capable of rather than vocal development, that might make it harder to like launch into some of these specific things that we've been talking about with like scaffolding up vocal cues. And so I'm curious how much you feel like that is a part of a lot of this early professional development, is looking for these milestones for providing developmentally appropriate responses. And if there is the room to maybe not overwhelm a brand new teacher, but to kind of move towards looking for, I don't know, I guess being tuned to specific cues that baby, more sensitive cues or more subtle cues that babies are throwing out there.
So I do think with pre-service teachers, so you mentioned that you're housed in a psychology department.
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm housed in a human development and family studies department. We share our students with our school of education. So they get birth to the end of preschool with us, and then kindergarten through third grade in a school of education. And those are different philosophies of preparation. So that's why I start out by saying this. So our students, because they get the development side, I think we do hit on all of those domains. So people most often recognize the physical milestones. You know, if somebody's not walking by a certain time, then, you know, the aunts and uncles are asking questions. That's the kind of milestones we think about. But we do look at language ones, and we actually teach students to use the Ages and Stages questionnaire, which is a broad screener for those different developmental domains. I actually was counting how many words of Josh's I could recognize the other day trying to fill out an ASQ. So as far as milestones, you know, I think they get all of those. I think two things, which is, this maybe, this wasn't actually where you're going, but I thought of it as you're talking. I think sometimes they get worried about almost teaching to the test, like teaching to the milestone, like this baby only knows 7 words and the ASQ asks if they know 8. And so I need to get one more word in there before we have to turn this in. And it's like, no, like, the assessments should work for us. We shouldn't work for them. Mm-hmm. But to your point about sort of this nuance and the quality of vocalizations and being responsive to that and being tuned into that, this is where I think as a profession, we need to recognize that we graduate generalists, and then we often throw them in a very specific context and say, figure it out. Nursing is a profession that I wish we learned more lessons from. They don't do that. You graduate a new nurse who's a generalist nurse. She has a, you know, a bachelor's in nursing, or he has a bachelor's in nursing. And then they get a job, and then they spend, like, depending on the location, 3 to 6 months in an orientation where they don't take care of anybody by themselves. You know, like, not that we don't trust them, but they get to learn from an expert. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine how meaningful that would be for teachers if when they move from kindergarten to second grade, they did a whole semester of co-teaching? So all that to say, I do think that teachers, like, that it would be wonderful them to know this. And I think if they were really targeting working with 1-year-old, then this becomes so much more, you know, they become so salient.
Yeah.
But because, at least for ours, while we have them, we're teaching them from 6 weeks through, you know, third grade science and literacy standards. We don't, right? It's wild. We don't make space for it. And then the other thing, and this is getting way more big picture than you were going, but of course I'm telling you about the students that take my class who are our licensure students. They're very rarely the ones that go work with infants and toddlers. And so we know that infants and toddlers, especially infants that are in childcare in the US, are more likely than older children to be with teachers who don't have a college degree or who have no advanced training, and especially right now as our country is in such a childcare crisis, to go really macro. So I do think your original question was, with all of the milestones and sort of the focus on physical development at this age, which is what we focus on, right? Like we obsess about their weight percentage and height percentage and all that percentile. I do think that more focus on these nuances of language is really helpful. And it's not, you know, like you said, it can be built in. It's built into your play interactions. It's built into your diaper changes if you just know what you're going for.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you're talking about the specialization, you know, parents come in generalist, right? It's like we know humans, and now we have this little person to keep alive. And you, but that single person trains us up and shapes our development, right?
And then you have a second one who's totally different.
Yeah. And you get reshaped, right? Yeah. But you're only having to get shaped to one child at a time. And this is the fascinating part of the teacher side of it, is like, aside from the education and the professional development and the training and the years of experience, just that dynamic of having, you know, 4 to 8 kids that are at very different points. Do teachers become even more specialized in a sense because they're getting all that rapid exposure to kids at different points? Or does that make it just almost too challenging to do? That's the kind of questions I really like to understand, because it kind of leads to, it's like, say, is, you know, can you make education components that would lead to kind of more specific tips and tricks? Or is that just not feasible in the same way and we should try a different approach because it's just not, you know, that's not worth it? And so I'd love to kind of just understand, this is, I think the next 5-10 years, I'm just trying to understand better all the different dynamics. And then maybe where do you go from that? What can you do with it?
Yeah. Yeah. There are many questions left to be asked. I will say that we have done some work. So we both mentioned the Cupid group, and I need to put the Cupid website on something when I post this so that I can share it. But some of the work we've done, we know that experience is important for folks who are learning to work with children. And so our students who come in with formal experience in a childcare setting of some sort, have different beliefs and knowledge. They look different than their peers who haven't. And we know that students who have a practicum have a different sort of learning over the semester trajectory than those who don't. So part of what I'm thinking is that as teachers have more and more experiences with different kids, it goes one of two ways, right? It goes where we talked about, to like robot voice, because it's exhausting to try to tune in to 12 different or 8 different or 4 different little people's ways of being in the world, or they do become super responsive and tuned in to how different children communicate, how much they want to communicate, you know, when they're ready to take it in.
And that what you just said there is exactly what I'm seeing in the data, is kind of this divide of teachers who are talking to talk and filling a lot of space versus teachers who are being more selective. And I'm really trying to capture, well, what is leading one teacher to go one way versus the other? Because in this initial sample that we've looked at, I'm not seeing, you know, huge predictors based off of years of experience or training, or we don't have a ton of like the attitudes kind of measures in this and stuff, because I'm working with the second secondary analysis. These are the kind of factors, is like, what predicts these individual differences in this variability? Because I think if you could identify some of those things, it would kind of say, okay, well, if this is the factor that's predicting this, then how do we target that factor? What would that look like?
This is where I go on to speculate that maybe the difference between teachers' contingent responding has to do with their own well-being and stress level. It's definitely something worth looking into. Thank you, Rachel, for joining me, and thank you, teachers, for taking the time to listen. We care for you. We appreciate you. We are cheering you on from afar. We hope that you are headed into some time, even if it's only a couple days, away to rest and be refreshed. We are so thankful for you. Teachers in the Tiny Chairs is recorded, edited, and produced by Christine Lippard. Music by Jason Lippard. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at The Tiny Chairs.